This week, gold recorded its second weekly gain, while the Dow Jones Industrials finished at yet another all-time record high. Welcome, everyone. Your host, Chris Walczak, here with you. We've got another big show lined up and top interviews from the biggest industry professionals, as well as the financial market headlines impacting your portfolio. 1 hour plus of infotainment headed this way. Bob Hoy from Institutional Investors thinks that we could be facing a year 2007-like stock market implosion, but that might be a good sign for the precious metals community. According to his work, the gold commodity ratio bottomed in June and is showing an uptrend, which suggests that precious metals miners could once again be the investment du jour. And David Morgan, the silver investor, outlines his research into fiat paper money. He says about 4,000 currencies have gone bankrupt in human history, but not one that was backed by precious metals has failed. The average length of a fiat currency is about 40 years, and guess how long the U.S. dollar has been in circulation? Over 41 years. David Morgan proposes a bimetallic standard where a simple mathematical algorithm could adjust the price of real money. Following the guidelines outlined by Hugo Salinas Price, central banks could sell 10% of their reserves, buy silver, and distribute it as coins to the people. And Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest editorial. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather report. Sunny skies appeared over the market for the second week running amid dollar weakness. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, gold was up about $10, finishing at $11.87. Silver added about 50 cents, finishing at $16.31, while the XAU gold index continued its heavenly ascent, up 2.5%, 2 points to $70.82, rebounding from those oversold lows. Palladium fell $7 at about $7.66. Platinum was off just two, ending at $12.15, while West Texas Intermediate crude was off $2.50, but well off the lows, down about 3% for the week, ending at $75.93 a barrel. Well, the top story moving the markets was dovish talk from the Federal Reserve that lower energy costs could hold inflation in check. Fed Bank of St. Louis President James Bullard spoke of inflation. The recent sell-off in the energy sector led Fed officials to conclude that inflation is obviously under control, and this was viewed as an upbeat positive for the precious metals and stocks because the Fed still has wiggle room and is likely to hold their interest rates at near zero for the foreseeable future. In related news, OPEC ministers increased diplomatic efforts in an attempt to garner a consensus to remedy that four-year low. Crude slump is increasing the likelihood that the producers will curtail output and help stabilize prices. Elsewhere, billionaire hedge fund manager John Paulson maintained his stake in the world's biggest gold-backed exchange-traded fund for the fifth quarter as prices dropped to a four-year low. Paulson & Company owns about 10.23 million shares in the Spider Gold Trust, according to an SEC filing. He first added gold way back in 2009, and he's holding on to it. Precious metals bottom line. The dollar fell back to support this week amid a potential floor in West Texas Intermediate crude and inflation chatter from Fed officials. Nevertheless, 1 week does not a bottom make. Further selling will be required to undo one of the most spectacular rallies in decades. Gold and silver bounced sharply, but neither have blasted through resistance. I'm cautiously optimistic that the worst is over, at least for the time being. Well, moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility virtually unlimited yet again over the New York Stock Exchange for the fourth week running. Dow Jones inched higher about 61 points, ending at 17,635, yet another all-time record weekly close in national history. The S&P 500 added 790, finishing around 2039, while the NASDAQ added 56, closing at 46.88. Driving these markets to new records, news that U.S. consumer confidence numbers were better than expected, combined with the best unemployment rate in years, was the perfect melange for robust corporate profits. This improves the outlook for share prices as companies add more employees to the payroll and the consumer is excited about opening the wallet and pocketbooks, well, that tends to be good for share prices. In addition, the bounce in crude oil futures on Friday pushed energy share prices higher. They were one of the best performers of the day. Crude futures rose about 2.2% up to about $75.82 a barrel in anticipation of OPEC efforts to find a price floor. Expectations that the Fed will hold rates near zero, also a big positive, essentially a safety net for investors. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, our trusty 7 indicator fear index was proven correct yet again over the past few weeks, keeping us fully invested during this near 2,000-point rally in just 4 weeks. But the market is now showing signs of losing some momentum, as one would expect after such a sharp rally. Greed is entering the market as we look at our index here, as the herd of investors are starting to become convinced that the pastures will remain green. I expect to see some profit-taking as soon as next week or so, and anticipate better entry opportunities. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with the silver investor David Morgan and Bob Hoy from Institutional Investors. We'd like for you to stay with us right here. Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
On November 30th, voters in Switzerland will head to the polls to vote on a referendum for the return or repatriation of their gold. On the ballot, a measure to prohibit the Swiss National Bank from further gold sales, bring back their gold, and this would be roughly about 20% of the bank's assets. Joining me to discuss this and many other topical issues, Bob Hoy, editor and chief investment strategist of institutionaladvisors.com. Welcome, Bob Hoy. I hope it's not as cold up there as it is down here on the East Coast.
Well, Chris, here in Vancouver, it's a sunny day, Memorial Day, as we call it, Remembrance Day. We're cooler than usual, the banana belt of Canada.
We know we were talking about some interesting issues before, and on this Veterans Day, a good time to remember those who have defended our land and our freedom and things that we enjoy and take for granted sometimes, and our families. We don't want to bore our listeners with those details, but we did get onto a more interesting topic, and that was the intelligence community behind winning the war. And by now, I think folks are just starting to recognize the significance of the intelligence community. For instance, it's been said Alan Turing's efforts may have ended the war by 6 to 12 months. Just one individual, one lone individual who might have just been an anecdote in history.
Well, that was cracking the German Wehrmacht code, and their concept of Blitzkrieg was rapid war with tanks and mobile troops controlled by radio. So then they put in a what they thought was a totally secure code, and the Poles got out with one of their Enigma machines, and then the Brits got onto it at Bletchley Park, and then there was a lot of permutation combinations with the dials on that thing. So then they developed a computer to be able to crack the code, and they were reading the messages almost at the same time as the field officers were in Europe.
Well, you know, there's a couple of interesting aspects. Firstly, Alan Turing sat down with many of the reports, and let's not forget that the Poles had done the initial work on cracking the Enigma, and they sent over need-to-know information to kind of get the ball rolling. He tinkered around with it, and he noticed a flaw. Sometimes the senders of these coded Axis messages mistakenly do something something they just weren't supposed to do. And they, you know, they were in a hurry. You know, there's probably bullets flying over their head. You know, they're not sticking with the protocol every time. They're in a submarine, call mines coming down. They would sometimes send off a little bit of information, which was sort of the cipher that went along with each message. Fortunately for us, they would use someone's name, a common name, a loved one, their fearless leader's name with a little twist on it. And that gave them a leg up. Another interesting, I think, side note here, every now and then there would be an interruption in a very important message, and they would send the same message twice. The cipher, the front part of the program, if you are, the algorithm, could be examined with greater detail, and it gave information. Then Turing sat down, as I understand it, with this and recognized, yes, there are hundreds of millions of permutations and combinations, but you are right to use the word permutation, making it even more complex. But using a computer, a makeshift computer, we can just use brute force and work our way through this, wind through it, and decipher it. And that's what they did. And it saved untold tens of thousands of lives on the maritime, on the sea, as well as on the battlefield. Tell us more, Bob.
You know, like any kid growing up back decades ago, you're very interested in the war and subsequent wars. I had a father, two uncles that served. In World War II, our family had no casualties. But I've always been fascinated with the planes and the spies, and as you mentioned, the cracking of the code, which was a very important to. And the Americans did do the heavy lifting in that struggle. And I think Europeans should be very thankful for the efforts that the Allies did, you know, collectively. So
I'd agree. And I'd also just throw another push in World War II along these lines, which I think gets sadly very little attention, is our efforts on cracking the Japanese codes carried on here in the United States on the East Coast primarily, had to create what I think is perhaps an even more remarkable computer. And they designed it from scratch and once again received very, very little attention. It's kind of just one of those anecdotes that we're only now starting to learn about, the efforts that went underway by some very top minds simply because the national security risk. We all remember Alan Turing, of course, for his effort at Bletchley Park. But as we were saying before the show, there were two other fellows who cracked the much higher ranking Enigma machine, and it had an extra wheel in it, yeah, which made it even more complex. And I think there was actually some plugs that could be pulled as well for switching around, and they cracked that. And it was so top secret that now their story is just coming out. So who knows what other interesting facets there are to history.
And I hope it continues to interest everybody.
Well, what is so interesting to me is that one of the individuals, he actually moved to Canada because he wanted to continue in the university, but they were just so concerned about security risks that he couldn't even stay in his own country. So isn't it interesting that these people who saved so many lives became anathema or even pariahs? We're going to switch over. As I mentioned at the beginning, we were talking about the referendum on the plate there in Switzerland. I'd like your thoughts on whether or not this trend, we're going to see this continue, or whether or not it's going to lose momentum.
Well, no, this is, I think, part of a very big picture whereby the experts have been running economies and financial markets and everything for far too long, 100 years. And so the experts have decided what money is, and it is meant a money designed to serve the state rather than the individual or the markets. And then on top of that, you've had the experts in central banking who've been running things, and then you have had in various levels of government very powerful committees who run things, and they then hire experts to advise them. And I think this thing with Switzerland will probably be part of a world movement whereby the public is going to take back their government and they're going to take back their money. And it'll offend the experts, but every time you offend an expert, you're doing a good thing. I don't think it'll move the gold market, but what it is it's a start. What I see 2 weeks ago, that the Central Bank of Russia was buying gold, which is a very practical thing to be doing.
Yeah, a news report just came out, I think, in the past few days that showed that what's going on with Russia is, due to these sanctions from the West, very few of their gold miners, you know, they're a major, not only oil producer, but they also produce high level of gold. They have huge territories up there. Miners are going out of business because they can't ship their gold. So the central bank is using their rubles.
I hadn't thought of that part. That's a good story. But the main thing is that this weakness in crude oil is reducing the amount of hard currency that Russia's getting. So, and then you've had their interest rates soaring. You've had capital flows out. So I think the financial markets will eventually curb Putin's ambition, who I think is a neo-Soviet, you know. You had the collapse, and no, it was, you know, 25 years ago when the Berlin Wall came down, marking an incredible ground-up urge to reform big and excessive government. And then, since the 90s, that was brief, the reform that swept the world, trying to get smaller government. And then, certainly since the late 90s, on with the booms and all that, that the left has become particularly ambitious. And so let's call the first movement with the wall coming down the equivalent of a great reformation. And of course, in the 1600s, you had the Protestant Reformation, and then you had a counter-reformation move. So what Obama and Putin have been doing is taking, in the case of Obama, a counter-reformation to the move by Reagan to reduce the size and influence of the state. But this is where your election here last week was a marvelous event, and I like the description of the wave, where people said, I've had enough of these taking my money and messing up my life. So they moved.
Keep it back here on point. With the gold repatriation, we first saw this movement, I think, sink its teeth into public consciousness with Hugo Chavez before he passed away. He repatriated, he was, I guess, one of the first movers here, repatriated most, if not all, of that nation's gold back to Venezuela. It just took off like a rocket, and we heard the Bundesbank rattling sabers, of course, the Swiss folks demanding its sovereign state gold back from the Federal Reserve.
An interesting movement, but this then, what we're looking for in the financial markets is that you've had a major turn in the credit markets in June, from joy and happiness to widening credit spreads, and in the case of junk prices, lower price, junk bonds, lower prices. So we think this is the start of a major credit contraction, similar to what started in June of 2007. Now, on top of this, you've had a very strong stock market, and it roared up into August and September, and this is where we describe this as the exuberant phase, where you had, for example, on technical measures, the percent bears were down to 13.3%. You haven't seen that since 1987. Then we have a proprietary model that deals with momentum and the length of the run, and it gave what we call an upside exhaustion readings August and September on the S&P on the monthly reading, and that has not been seen since just before the blow-off top in 2000. So the exuberance has been phenomenal. Then you had the divergence where the small caps, the Russell 2000, began to underperform, and Europe market made its high in June, July, and then rolled over and took out key moving averages. So you had that divergence. And then you have then came into the market was the volatility, and you had the VIX shoot up on a tremendous move. It's given it all up now. But so we think that those, all of those things, the exuberance, the divergence, and the volatility are of the nature that you see at important cyclical peaks for the stock market. And then you got the correction about 10%. And then you had some of our indicators on junk bonds and the S&P got oversold. We had the what we call a springboard buy.
We just issued a buy today on an interesting junk portfolio. It trades like a stock, like an ETF. It's HYLD, about a 9% dividend yield. Talk about oversold. That just sparked my memory. It looks like a great opportunity for people to increase the income in their portfolios with very little risk. HYLD. Please continue, sir.
So anyways, ahead of the European Bank, he promised, he renewed his vows to inflate as hard as he could. And then came the really big surprise where the Japanese Central Bank did another one of those 5% depreciations.
They're following right in Bernanke's footsteps. I mean, they're using their own QE methods. And what's happening is you're seeing a huge flood of capital into the United States stock market as a result. When is that going to reverse, I guess is the question.
They're promoting the stock market with the hopes if they can keep that together, then the economy will continue to do well. So that was another one that was surprised. And then on top of that, about a week before the election, there was some, you could get a sense that, hey, this is going to go for the Republicans, which one would take for a plus for the stock market. So it's had a number of special opportunistic news things come out, and they're in the market now. Also, the other one that's in the market is the seasonal move from lows in October through to highs in May. We're not at lows in October right now. We're at new highs in the market. So let's just be cautious here on the overall stock market, because underneath it, the credit spreads continue to widen. So they're vulnerable. The other one that we've been watching, we're looking for, was weaker commodity prices. But we want to back up a couple of months and note that the grains, and we use the ETF GYX on that for the agricultural prices, and it has been really beat up since its big high in 2011. But it was so beat up, so exhausting of analysis, and then it started to flatten out, and that one we thought had the best opportunities for a rally, and it continues to recover.
Bob, I don't think we can talk about the commodities markets or the precious metals without taking a good, solid look at the U.S. dollar. And the greenback, of course, what a remarkable rally. The interesting thing is, on a weekly basis at least, we found a very solid support, although it seemed to top a bit last week, at recent resistance. So now resistance that had held it in check for about 3 years near lows has become support. Do you expect support to hold, setting the stage for a springboard to new highs in the greenback?
Well, we're bullish on the U.S. dollar, mainly for the reason that in previous post-bubble contractions, the senior currency becomes chronically strong against most other currencies and most commodities. So, but maybe it's near-term overbought in here. We've been looking for a seasonal low in copper around now and a seasonal low for crude oil in December. It's getting a little oversold. So it looks primed for maybe in December we can get a good rotation into some of the beat-up commodities, including gold and silver. Now, our view on gold is how is it compatible with our view of a firmer dollar and life coming back into the gold industry. And for that, we drop back and look at the gold's real price. So that's where you take the price of gold and deflate it by the CPI, the PPI, or the old wholesale price index, or as we do it, against our own commodity index. So the gold side of the equation in the investment markets has got so used to looking at gold in U.S. dollars and looking at the dollar and hating the Fed and then getting even by buying gold and gold stocks, you know. But that is, when you look at it, Chris, It is speculating in the U.S. dollar. It's not investing in the gold business. Investing in the gold business is buying the stocks when you think profitability is going to come back into the gold mining business. And profitability in the gold mining business does not depend upon a plunging U.S. dollar, which has been the formula of the gold bugs for so many decades. Because there are times when the dollar was plunging, gold was soaring, but crude oil was going up faster, and crude oil represents energy costs to the gold mining business. So let's just be all quiet and analytical about this and look at the real price. And as we look at it, we divide it by our own commodity index, because we couldn't use the economist, and you wanted an index that did not have gold in it. Well, the reason for that is we don't think gold is a commodity. We think it's money. So that gold by divided by commodities index set its low in June, and it now has, a five-month uptrend, and we think the next breakout will be very good for it. So it's reflecting an improving profit condition for the gold mining.
Let's talk about that, because, I think this is a key component on the supply issue. All we hear about is demand. Demand is so robust. Silver Eagles, for instance, our U.S. Mint just halted all Silver Eagle sales amid record demand. We talk about demand around the world. We talk about China. We talk about Asian demand. We talk about India. Both consume more than half of the world's output, and China can consume easily the entire world's output in a year. But let's talk about supply, because I think this is what hitting on there, the issue of low gold price and the fact that according to Bloomberg's analysis, Bloomberg.com and the network, their analysts are showing, approaching the threshold where a majority of the major miners cannot receive enough money from the sale of the gold. In other words, the price of gold is simply so low that it is making operations costly and difficult. And of course, when this happens, obviously people start to curtail projects. They stop exploration. On the one hand, that's bad for us, those of us who are in the industry. But on the other hand, eventually the basic laws of supply dictate that you will have higher price to compensate. Tell us more.
Okay, well, supply-demand analysis, my forecasting advisory business essentially started in 1976 here in Vancouver when I took the metals work to two big mining companies, then Cominco and Placer. And I realized then that the culture of mining is that you got to know about supply-demand, and eventually realized that you cannot forecast a price based upon supply-demand analysis. It's just bloody hopeless. For example, in gold, the World Gold Council goes on about jewelry consumption, very important. Well, of course, in a boom financial mania like we've been in, the jewelry consumption has been growing very nicely. People are buying all sorts of lovely items. But then when you get a stock market crash, such as in 2008 or 1929, the rich people run out of money, too, and jewelry sales drop. But it's a completely useless calculation, because in a crash, that's when the investment demand for gold soars. So jewelry doesn't matter at all. So the investment demand soars in a financial contraction, and that is because gold provides a certain liquidity, and the other liquidity is in T-bills, in the senior currency, which still happens to be U.S. dollars. So we don't subscribe. We think that supply-demand analysis is a trap, and we avoid it as best we can and continue to look at gold and silver prices on their own and related to the credit markets. Now, here's where the silver guys get themselves into a box, because every year that I've been in the business, there's been greater consumption of silver than there has been production. And the guys get all excited about that. But the problem is, we live in a day-to-day financial market, and in a boom, the gold-silver ratio acts like a credit spread, and it narrows. It the ratio goes down. And then in a bust, the ratio goes up. And let's look back to the big promotion in 1980 where the Hunt brothers attempted to corner silver. And they felt that it was God-given right that the gold-silver ratio should be 15 or 16, because that's where it was 200 years ago. And then came the crash and then the long unwinding of positions in gold, silver, and base metals and crude oil and everything else, so that the gold-silver ratio got up to 104 in early 1991. Wow. And that is when Chase Manhattan and Chemical Bank, Chase and Citigroup, got in such bad shape they had to be bailed out by the Fed. And that was they were unwinding positions in hard assets. So you got 104. Then on the next boom, let's just jump ahead to 2007 boom, and it got down to something like 40. And then it rose in that crash. I don't know. I'm just remembering him. I think it got up to about 90. And then recently into the 40s, and now we're around 50. What are we, 60, 70? Yeah, 74 now. And we think it's on the way to 100. So you can't figure that the gold-silver ratio is going to go to 100 by looking at the supply-demand of silver. It plain just doesn't work, and we prefer to stay with what does work, which is using technical sentiment analysis on the price of those two important metals, and then connecting it to the credit markets.
Well, connect it to the credit markets for us, would you please?
Yeah, but we can even do one step more, and we'll show you how we used it to get out of the gold market. Is that in any ordinary bull market for gold and silver, silver outperforms gold. So then you take a look at the momentum on the silver-gold ratio, and whenever that RSI on that gets above 78, it's highly speculative. In 2011, the RSI on the silver-gold ratio got to 92. And the last time it was at 92, and the only other time, was in January 1980 at the top of that blow-off. Then you had a big correction in gold and silver, and then back up to September of 2012, and the RSI then got to 86, which at the time we wrote that that was very dangerous. Over-speculation was going to go down. And then this brings us to December a year ago when we thought the rotation, as we called it, you would have a good rally in some of the dead commodities, including gold and silver, up until the spring, and gosh, there were some great rallies in some of the gold stocks there, but guess what happened to the silver-gold ratio on the RSI? It got up to 84 in May, and that's when we said, hey, it's dangerous speculation again, take the money off the table. So now on the gold sector, we're now advising to begin to nibble away and buy a few gold stocks, whatever you're suitable for your portfolio.
Very good, Bob. But, you know, hindsight 2020, I wonder if you could give us a little glimpse into your reasoning behind this.
Oh, yeah, because we're now extremely oversold on gold divided by, on the gold shares divided by gold. You want to look at that because at the bottom or at the top for the gold bullion price, gold stocks lead the change in the bullion price. So what we're looking for here now, and we've had a couple of days where gold shares have outperformed gold. But what we want on that is a couple of weeks of gold shares outperforming gold. And that's where we said that for nimble traders, begin to buy a few of your favorite gold shares. And then wait until gold shares actually set an uptrend, and then they will lead by maybe 3 or 4 weeks or so the turn in bullion. And then once both get turned, then one could take larger positions. So just to sum it up, Chris, we're very close to a bottom in gold shares and that would lead a bottom in the bullion price.
Take a look at these charts on a monthly and a weekly basis. Just go back about a decade. The decimation is really intense, and I don't say this to pour salt in open wounds. From a sentiment oversold perspective, we've reached levels on the XAU not seen, at least from my perspective, since 2008, and that was a harrowing sell-off. And you can really take it back before that. You could say now we're approaching levels near the beginning of one of the greatest bull markets in history.
I remember a legend here in Vancouver decades ago. It was a really wiped out gold market. Junior companies were surrendering their charters and all that sort of stuff. And this in the days before, answering services and all that sort of stuff. So if the company was alive, it would have a phone. So this broker, who, you know, at the bottom of the market, you're not going to afford to having a secretary. So he gets a list of the companies he thought were all right and phone numbers, and he phones each one during the business day. And if somebody answered the phone, he hung up and bought the stock. We're close to that point now. So I'm going to leave it there that we got the lead from one thing, which is the real price is increasing. That declined for 2 or 3 years. And although most in our business don't follow it, the earnings do, or the ability to earn does. So it's been rising since June. And then now if you get a couple of weeks here with the gold stocks outperforming gold, that's a very positive step. Anyways, always good to talk.
We'll look forward to having you back on the show, and tell folks more about the services you provide as we wrap up,
please. Yeah, we cover institutions and high net worth people and very people who really like the gold business. And you can find us on the website at institutionaladvisors.com, or thanks to the internet, just Google my name, BOBHOYE, and up it comes, and we offer a trial service for, a couple of months, whatever it takes.
Excellent. We wish you continued success. Can't wait to have you back on the show, Bob.
Very good.
David Morgan writes the Morgan Report and runs SilverInvestor.com. It's a pleasure to have him back on the show. Welcome, David Morgan.
Well, thank you, Chris. Great to be with you.
We had a tough year here. We started off to the races, and then they started the QE operations in reverse. I guess they wrapped that up. And, of course, now, though, we're seeing our neighbors to the right across the pond in the European Union. They're starting their own QE operations. And then, of course, across the Pacific, the Bank of Japan is also following in Dr. Bernanke's footsteps. Give us an idea here on what you see in the markets and just what this means for our investors, please.
Well, I have to start at the most basic, because without understanding it, there's people that will make wrong decisions, which means it's imperative that they understand. I just got back from a conference in Spain, and it was with people that have very little financial background, but most of them are pretty high-powered type of people. They just have different interests in life than, stocks or bonds or, money or any of that thing. So I started with the baby step, and I said, take out your currency. And I took out a U.S. note, and Federal Reserve variety. And they had euros and pesetas and pound sterlings or whatever. It was an international conference. And I said, think about everything about that piece of paper that you think about, quote-unquote money. And I use quote-unquote. It's really currency. And, the hopes, the dreams, you have enough, you want to make more, whatever you attach to that. And now, how surprised would you be to know to the honest truth that all that really is a piece of paper? That's all it is. And I went on and from there, and of course, I'm not going to give the whole lecture, but, the basics. But unless you understand that all currencies, all 3,827, or whatever the exact number was roughly 3,500 or 3,800, have failed. And gold can't fail. It could certainly change value. I mean, this, the golden constant that I've referred to many times is referring that an ounce of gold remains constant. The value of gold can vary like the value of anything. I mean, what was the, cost or the price of the first cell phone and what was it like? I mean, you know, so gold does vary in value. It's very undervalued right now by historic metrics. But nonetheless, it doesn't fail. It doesn't go to zero. It never went out of style. It's used anywhere in the world. I mean, when you're in a foreign country, you either have to exchange for their currency because they're not going to take U.S. dollars. I mean, everyone thinks, well, I've got dollars. Well, dollars are worthless outside of the borders, except a few cases. I mean, there are countries in the, outside the borders that do take it, but many won't. So anyway, I'm off on a tangent. Chris, you can bring me back in. But I just want to go back to the fundamentals because people, sometimes the simplest solution is to go right to the very foundational argument. And it is that simple. Paper currency has always failed. It's a 100% certainty. So now the big question is when, and the average is 40 years. And we went off the gold standard August 1571. You had 40 years. You're in 2011. It's not a precise, exact 40 years. That's not how, you know, humanity runs. But we're due. So you've got two factors that are fundamentally fact. It's not argument. It's not debatable. It's not opinion. It's fact. All currencies up till now have always failed. That's 100% true. And secondly, the average is around 40 years. So those are things to bear in mind. So even though the prices are down, an ounce of gold, still an ounce of gold, an ounce of silver, still an ounce of silver, and they're still recognized as money anywhere in the world, particularly gold, silver in most places.
Take a look at your analogy. Thousands of currencies, were it only 30, maybe that you would start to approach statistical significance. But when you start to get over 300, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, what we're all suffering under is a almost unanimous delusion, the fata morgana that the entire world has been lured into, and it's a very enticing illusion to suffer under, I suppose, because there's a tendency to accumulate great wealth for a small fraction of people. And after a while, the herd, you know, is chasing towards that oasis. But unfortunately, only a few of the very lucky become that 1% of 1%. And the rest, of course, eventually go bankrupt. So it's this illusion that must just over time, generation after generation, country after country, lures us all to an inevitable self-destruction.
Yes, it is inevitable. I called the lecture Money Magic. And the money magic was that it's magic to make you believe that that's money. Because, and it only lasts as long as it lasts. And again, 40 years is the rough, you know, round number. You know, I've had arguments with very intelligent people. I mean, these guys are, but, you know, some of the people that oppose us make a statement such as, well, in the long run, you might be right, but, you know, not in my lifetime or my kid's lifetime. You know, kind of like they know. Well, I don't know when it's going to happen, but I do know what the average time frame is. And I also know what the outlook is in the bond market. And I also know what's going on in the oil market. I mean, I look at all these markets, particularly the metals, as you well know. Things are not bright out there. There's a little deception going on. They rig the numbers. I mean, let's face it. When's the last time we really got an objective truth out of any of the political class anywhere on the planet? I mean, I think Putin's probably the only one that I would say, from what I can determine, shoots straight on a few issues. But even there, you know, you got to ask, well, libertarian, I don't care what stripe you are, they all use a monetary system. Every single one of them uses a monetary system, and that's never brought into the discussion. So if it's all about a one-world currency, you really think at the end of the day that there's going to be one-world currency and there's going to be a faction that says, oh, no, we're not going to participate in it? Is that possible? Sure it is. But maybe a lot of this drama is going on. I mean, we've learned from history that many wars were supported on both sides by the banksters. Is that what's going on again? I certainly wouldn't rule it out.
I think we should qualify, though, that we're not against a monetary system, against a fiat system, and we are for a sound money system. This is a tired cliche now, but we were all born into the Matrix. I was born in 69, so, you know, I guess you could say it really went into full force 2 years later. But, I mean, for most of us that are baby boomers or beyond, I mean, we're essentially in the Matrix. And I think after a while, we just lose touch with reality because we've been in the system so long. We are the rats that have been on the treadmill for so long that we don't know that there's another reality out there. And that's why we need, I think, the perspective of our elders. It may sound funny today. We just had Ron Paul on the show and the President Andrew Jackson fighting the central bank, but this time it looks like the banks are winning. But inevitably, we will be victorious. Why don't you tell listeners how?
Well, I think that the truth always wins out. I mean, that's very idealistic to say that, but, you know, and it's a lie that you can get something for nothing. And the whole system is based on the fact that the Federal Reserve has an endless checkbook. It's really counterfeiting, so they're getting something for nothing. They give it to their Wall Street compadres, and they get to use it first, and it goes into certain asset classes. It's particularly gone in the stock market of late, meaning the last several months. And it's just a big scam because there's no value involved. I mean, there's nothing super magic about gold. It's just that it's a policeman on the system because it takes work, effort, to make it, and it only increases at about 1.5% a year. So you've got to, you know, all the sustainability's out there. That's sustainability. You got a slow growth rate. It doesn't mean that necessarily the economy grows at 1.5%. It means that the money supply grows at 1.5%. It's a much more stable system. And really, if you study it really hard, you'll find that bimetallic systems or trimetallic systems actually work the best. The only problem with most bimetallism is that it's a fixed ratio between gold and silver. That causes problems. It can't be. It's got to be a floating exchange between gold and silver where the determination is made in the free market what how many ounces of silver equals an ounce.
I think that's a great segue into my next topic about your idea of bimetallicism. And this is so important. There really was an epic struggle, a battle that was being waged between the West and Eastern banking interests, particularly with regard to the silver component. We have a digital world. It would be an instantaneous ratio change. You know, there's suddenly a gold find in Timbuktu, or there's a silver find in Butte, Montana. Instantly, the ratio could be adjusted. It's a simple mathematical algorithm that would take care of this for us. Hugo Salinas Price, you know, brilliant idea, and he and Max Keiser took it to the Greek officials. All you central bankers, you've got hundreds of billions of dollars of gold in your stockpiles. If you just take 10% and invest it in this wildly underpriced silver, which is also a monetary metal, you could then distribute this to your people, still have 90% of your reserves, and you would have this underlying currency that could help restore normalcy to your economy. Tell us more about this interesting idea.
You outlined it very well, and you know, Hugo and I have known each other for quite some time, and I'm one of his fans. He proposed the Libertad coin, the silver coin in Mexico, to be circulated alongside the peso. And he really thought it through, and I think he did it right. I mean, it's easy to take pot shots at somebody and say, well, it'd be better if. But what he did was he said that it starts at a ratio that it can never drop below. So since it's used in circulation, it would have a value, say silver is at 15, okay, and then it gets to 20. And I forget the parameters, but the idea is if it's at 20 for 30 days or greater, then the new value is at 20. Now, if it drops to 18, it can never go below 20 in circulation. That was the idea. And it has to be that way because you have to be able to use it as a unit of account, et cetera. But really was pretty well thought out, pretty simple, but a great idea. And, of course, what the result was is that, like, 24 governors out of 24 in Mexico were for it. They did a couple surveys. The vast majority of the Mexican people were for it. And, of course, the only people that were not really enthused about this idea was the banking system. And Hugo explained at GATA 21 and other places, I've spoken to him many times, was to just get your foot in the door. Basically, you just crack the door open and you let silver circulate side by side with the paper currency. And then over time, what will happen is that you will see that people will start saving in silver and spending fiat. Gershom Law will continue, of course, but you will introduce it where more and more people become aware of it. Because right now, many people have no idea what money is. In fact, my little lecture at the end of this seminar that I was speaking about in Spain, was all about waking people up to what the difference is. And I had one guy come up afterwards and say, you know, he never actually looked at a note before. He had no idea that, the Federal Reserve was a private corporation. He had no idea that it's really an IOU nothing. I mean, all these things that the hard money cap takes for granted. But, you know, on a more esoteric level, but a fundamentally can't print wealth, resurface the introductory to hyperinflation film that I did at the Old Glory Mint a few years ago. And it shows, you know, when the Zimbabwe dollar started out, it was one for one with the U.S. dollar. It really was. A lot of school teachers were retired, and their retirement income was $30,000 a year, okay? And that's, you know, I mean, think about, I don't know, 10 years ago or whatever. I mean, it's not a ton of money, but, you know. But then the inflation started, and they went from, you know, $1 equals a dollar, one Zimbabwe dollar equals one U.S. dollar, to by the time they printed the $100 trillion notes, they couldn't get them into the bank to use them. The currency had collapsed. Now, I don't see that happening in the West, by the way. I don't really see that happening for the dollar at all. I see an inflation. I see a currency rejection, but I don't see where it's going to have to get nearly that high for that to happen.
People really do require a sea change in their thinking. And it's funny to watch that light bulb go off when you meet someone who just can't wrap their mind around the idea that the currency must eventually, as you say, be rejected, because that's what it does. It slowly and meticulously eviscerates the purchasing power in every nation that this experiment has ever been taken. A lot of great stuff here for our listeners today. Anything else you want to share with folks as we wrap up?
No, that'll do it. And because it is so important, I certainly like them to continue education. If you're interested in all things silver particularly, you can go to our website. Lots of free information. Charles Savoy is someone I don't mention often enough. He's done a great deal of research on silver as money, and he talked about what happened with the Western and Eastern factions with the silver versus gold setup. That goes back to London, England, far before that. Not that that one is invalid, certainly is very valid. But Charlie's done more work in that than anybody. I think if you want to really get an education, if this interests you, get on silver-investor.com, go in the archive section and read everything that Charles Savoy has written over the last decade and more, and get a real education on the silver market. If there's really a metal, I mean, this sounds interesting, that's really been suppressed, more than gold, it's silver. I mean, the amount of angst by the banking establishments against silver is phenomenal. I mean, in a way, they've won because they've, you know, everyone now believes silver is just an industrial metal. There's only a few nuts that know that the monetary history is really based on silver a lot more than gold. It's circulated more times, more places, and so many more transactions has been done in silver than in gold. In fact, Milton Friedman said that the monetary metal of history is silver, not gold, and that's a direct quote. But anyway, Chris, I'll wrap it up. We've got free stuff on YouTube at Silver Guru, free stuff on Twitter at SilverGuru22. The website, you can get our free once-a-week letter, which means I'm giving you a lot of my hard-fought work and, you might say, blood, sweat, and tears, because I want people to be educated. I want them to wake up. If they want to go further, we have some opportunities for them to do that on the website.
Well, you know, I think it's just so ironic that you'd mentioned Milton Friedman, the father of monetary economics, stating that silver, more than gold, is real sound money. That's an interesting quote. It just illustrates that the greatest minds, whether or not they were pro-Keynesianism or neo-Keynesianism or not, they knew deep down, just like Dr. Greenspan just admitted. Sure, Dr. Greenspan, very familiar with Milton Friedman's work, Chicago School of Economics. But it's just something that's too difficult for people's minds to wrap around. And maybe it's a cliche, but you've pointed this out in a lot of your work, and you have here on the show for almost a decade here on Gold Seek Radio, that we had silver circulating really up until only recently, where Gresham's Law once again exerted its influence and people recognized, I'm pulling the silver quarter, these silver dimes, this silver half, this is going to be pulled out of circulation because it's worth a lot more than any establishment's going to give me. You know, I can take this and sell it on eBay for $5, but it only buys a 25-cent gumball. So you've brought up a lot of great information today. We're going to look forward to having you back on GoldSeek.com Radio.
Thanks so much, Chris. It was a real pleasure.
Hey, Chris. This is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Several weeks ago, I discussed how many insurance companies would not be disclosing health insurance premium increases until November 15th this year. A full 45 days later than last year, and conveniently, 11 days after the midterm elections. Since my broadcast discussing this matter, I have received comments from listeners detailing what they expect will be their own increases this year. I also received a notice in the mail from my insurer indicating my premium was increasing 54% over last year. That's right, 54%. Over last year. Can somebody remind me, are we including healthcare premiums in the official inflation calculations? If we are, for the average person, like me, inflation is going to be a whole lot more than the 1 or 2 or 3% as is officially advertised. But then again, we've known that for a long, long time. As with a lot of things, prices don't stay down for a long time. It's a week after the election and gold has shot up $40 in one day, and silver nearly a dollar. But that never gets noticed or advertised, as does a $40 price drop in one day. In fact, gold can and will reach its recent levels from where it collapsed so hard from recently, and much of the world, as in the general public and mass media, will probably not notice until the next large swing to the downside. Then it will once again be front page news. We are fast approaching the best and worst times of the year for many people. The holidays. Thanksgiving, Hanukkah, Christmas, and New Year's. The holidays are going to be difficult from an economic perspective. Family and friends don't need more stuff this holiday season. They already have too much of it. It's not making them happy. It costs too much, and it will be obsolete before you know it. The best thing of value you can give this holiday season is your time and your point of view. Ideas, your perspectives for surviving this maze of trouble that we're in as individuals, as a country, as a world, are the most valuable gift you can give. It's likely your ideas may fall on deaf ears as they probably have in the past. But if you've ever thought about sharing your point of view one more time, because things are getting worse with higher prices, guaranteed political fighting with no definable solutions the next 2 years, and a set of challenges that only personal innovation from the ground up, starting with you, will begin to solve, at least for you and maybe some of your family and friends, then now is the time to share your unique point of view one more time about gold, the economy, and the future as you see it and how to achieve it. Because by this time next year, things will have escalated to where it will be a much harder sell. Chris, I'll be hosting the next Liberty Mastermind webinar on November 25th, 2 days before Thanksgiving. Registration is free and details are on my website. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.